Welcome to Film Interrupted. My name's Jack.
My name's Martin.
My name's Nick.
This week we'll be discussing prison movies. I'd actually pitched this as I wanted to do specifically French prison movies, and I did manage to like weasel my way into two of the three films we're talking about being French, but more generally prison movies. This is not something I'm overly drawn to, but it's something that I've noticed, like looking back in my back catalogue or picking out in films from a certain year. Prison movies crop up a lot, so maybe I like them more than I've been willing to admit. But that in itself is, you have to ask yourself, what's so appealing about a prison movie? Or what is it that makes it, that draws me to it? You must have some sort of an opinion on this, I'm sure. Either one of the two of you.
Prison? I mean, it's high drama, isn't it? Like, it's an emotionally intense situation where only the people at the extremes of the spectrum are placed in the same environment and closed space, and then it's like tension all the way through. Add to that the mechanics of an escape, which is like two out of the three films that we watched specifically for the podcast this week, and it's no difficult to see why they would be particularly well thought of.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, they offer a great enclosed dramatic setting, and they offer a really good opportunity to put yourself in someone's shoes, or really not want to put yourself in someone's shoes. You know, it's I think it's a classic guy thing of how would I do in prison? And
yeah,
you want to be like, in that environment, like which one of those people would I be, or could I be? What could I avoid? What could I achieve? That kind of stuff. Yeah, so there's definitely, you know, a lot of room for sort of imaginative. I don't think that's the right kind of term for it.
I know what you mean though. Like, there's a lot of room for you to like viscerally put yourself in someone else's shoes. Although, I mean, yeah, I suppose that I do feel that way about it, but. I mean, I would never think that I have any chance of survival in prison. Like, prison would be my worst nightmare. There is nothing that you could do that would be worse than me going to prison, because I've got absolutely no skills with the type of people who would be in prison, and my only option would be to make myself sexually available to anyone who wanted it, you know?
You can just, like, buy cigarettes and stuff instead.
No, like, that would be my instinct one, is like, right, this has happened, this is all about, like, survival, and, you know, all that's it.
So everyone's, like, worst nightmare about prison is your, like, first default option.
Absolutely, like... go on.
I was just going to say, I'd agree it's definitely a guy thing. It's just sort of this masculine thing where, you know, not even, you know, how would I? It's like, could I? Like, could I survive, like, a month? Could I survive, like, a year? And then you get into, like, decades and things like that, and just even trying to process that. And it is, like, the worst of nightmares you can possibly put yourself in.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm actually allowed to talk too much about my work, but I'll try and be coy as far as I can. But part of my work involves insurance, and I'll leave
you sound
it at
like
that.
Such a criminal.
Okay, there was a case recently about a bloke who defrauded an insurance company for like £60,000. It was like a completely bogus claim, and he was filmed like in surveillance out playing football. I think it was a leg injury that he was alleging, but he'd been out, you know, playing rugby actually it was, and he's been shown to have absolutely no injury whatsoever, and he got sentenced and he got like 8 months or something like that, but he wasn't financially penalised. He wasn't asked to pay back the £60,000, and someone who I worked with was saying like he would do that for £60,000, spend 8 months in prison. Mm-hmm. Like, that would be a deal that he would make if he could. I actually couldn't. As much as people talk about prisons being soft and prisons like being completely cozy, happy places where prisoners are treated like royalty, it's absolute bullshit. And
People actually talk about prisons being cozy, happy places?
Yeah. Ask a Daily Mail reader.
Yeah. So. A popular part of the dialogue when it comes to, you know, prisoners in this country having any rights as far as their own care or an opportunity for education or any kind of entertainment. If as far as, like Nick says, the Daily Mail is concerned, if prisoners aren't just in a wet, damp basement tomb all alone in the dark, then prison's not being done right.
Yeah. I mean, if you... It's the perspective of people who have no involvement in prison, like me. But I don't find it difficult to imagine that if you work in a prison, it's very easy to see yourself thinking that as much as these are terrible people, like, you can't just completely degrade and dehumanise them.
I think my question for your friend would be if he has any involvement with people that spend time in prison. Because, in all honesty, it depends who you are and where you're from. I mean, there's lots of people from lots of areas of the city that if they go to prison, it's just meeting up with old friends.
See, that's just
and
that.
It's passing in and out. And if you've got your group of people from your area, then you're fine. But if you're a stray among them, then that's not a pleasant experience.
I do worry about that aspect of it, that people could go into prison and be like, just be like from a bad area with bad friends and a bad surrounding, and prison only intensifies that because you're now in a situation that is like massively more combative, massively more intense, but you're still in basically the same environment where it's like survival with your, you know, with your idiot friends, and you just walk out like a more intense version of the person that you went in as.
My cousins came out of jail. It's like second, third cousins. This is me put as much distance between me and them as possible. Did you see that? And they came out and they were telling, I think it was my uncle, that they can guess his PIN number just by looking at his card. And they learned it in prison. And there's a trick about combinations of numbers on your card and your preset PIN that you get, and he knew it immediately. And
what?
He just,
is you that can true? Look at,
that's true. It's common knowledge amongst like credit card fraud and things like that, that the preset PIN you get with your card is derived from your credit card number in some way. I don't know it. I wouldn't care to advertise it on our podcast if I did, but I don't know it. I think that, can't say it's true in the US, but I know it was true in the UK at that time. Cause he guessed my uncle's PIN number and he was just stunned. And then, you know, he then immediately changed it. And I think he was then guessing as like, is it your birthday? Is it your address? Something like that. And he was running down like the things it would be immediately after that. So these are like, if you're in a place with bad people that you can survive a minimal effort, you're going to not spend your time and effort surviving, but learning the skills that they have, because that was people's lives and that's what led them there. And in my situation, I just like, okay, this is how I put myself through it. But we're talking about zombie movies, and I'm like, talking about everyone has this, like a zombie survival plan. I think like every guy in the same way has like a prison survival plan, but it's far more vague. You just got less options. You know, you're not going to like run here and do that and build barricades, but just how you'd survive it. I said, put on my Ned persona that I used when I lived in a scheme to get by, but I don't know if I could be that character to survive months or years in prison, but that's what I'd have to do.
We're going to need more gold.
I don't know how I would do it. And this is how bizarre it is. Like, I can think about the zombie apocalypse, and I can think about surviving that more easily than I can think about surviving prison for, like, a month.
I think it depends on your, you know, your level of commitment to prison, you know? I mean, if you're in for murder, you might as well just go straight in and, you know, stab someone in the eye anyway, just to, like, you know, put down a marker, and then you're fine. But, you know, if you're only in for, like, you know, some traffic stuff, and it's 3 months, that'd be inappropriate, so... You know.
I am the ideal candidate for a stabbed in the eye victim. So... For me, like, again, my prison survival is massively... Like,
don't worry, you'll be okay, because remember, in Ghost of the Civil Dead, it says, if you kill a nobody, it makes you a nobody.
Oh, well, that's
so
fine then, yeah.
You can be comfortable in that regard, that only in prison terms, as you've said yourself, that, you know, want to be pretty low on the totem pole.
Yeah, for sure. I think invisibility would be my... would be the thing that I would want to achieve. I would want to, like, if I could guarantee that prison would be solitary confinement. Like, if that was, they say, like, would you rather have, you know, solitary confinement or actually some group time? Definitely solitary. Like, in a heartbeat, solitary confinement.
Yeah, you're gonna have to murder some guards.
Yeah, that's just that. You know, I'd have to make myself a monster.
Mm-hmm. I think that would drive me insane. Just going back to the comparison,
I'd actually talk about some films rather than.
No, that. I know. I was getting there, and in the same way that I would, like, you know, I'd watch zombie films to see how someone played out on their way of surviving that environment. I don't watch prison films to see how that measures up to my own ideal of how I'd survive. I think I watch prison films for one of two reasons, and that is I watch it to see the escape and to empathise with someone I wouldn't normally empathise with. Martin, you were talking about Oz, like, a few episodes back, and, like, you can see someone who is, like, you know, you're a horrible, horrible person, and I'm so, so sorry about what's, you know, just happened to you or about to happen to you. And I've never seen that show, but I see that in a lot of prison movies. The second reason is a bit more perverse. It's just how nasty that environment can be. And you talked about drama, but that is, like, a series. I feel it's quite perverse on my part to see what happens. Just how bad things can get or how much it will turn someone a certain way. And, you know, I'm not very proud to wear that on my sleeve, but I'd apply to David Fincher's philosophy that all film viewers are perverts in terms of prison films. This is very much watching someone suffer for your pleasure. And as much as I take sort of moral high ground as I get older on sort of nastier horror films, I still get that kind of visceral, perverse observational pleasure from prison movies. Let's start with the sore thumb from the pack. You just mentioned it too. Ghost of the Civil Dead. And I've seen it, Martin. I know you've seen it, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it in anticipation of the show, but I had no prior knowledge of it whatsoever. I'd imagined it was actually a period piece just because of the title. I assumed it was like some sort of period epic from the Civil War, but very much not. It's a trippy, futuristic film written by Nick Cave and directed by John Hillcoat. Mm-hmm. So I think they've been pretty frequent collaborators, haven't they?
Yeah, they crop up together pretty regularly. I mean, I came across it doing an Australian cinema course at uni, and it was just part of the supplementary viewing. And the name Hillcoat, you know, jumped out as, well, I've seen this and that, so I'll go back to the earlier thing. And yeah, it's a really visually striking film. It's really dark, foreboding sort of tone to it. It plays its drama out in a kind of a kind of forecast for what the world's becoming, and places prison as not just a place and an experience for prisoners to go through and come out of and rejoin society, but a kind of a crucial part of conditioning society and building fears and maintaining fears and using that to control people and to have less freedoms and more power and more money for a select few. It goes to the edges of kind of conspiracy theory nut job, but conspiracy theory nut job theories can be scary and alarming and interesting, and that's what I think you get in this film.
Yeah, totally. I mean, had you seen it before, Jack?
I did. I saw it about the same time Martin did. He was just talking about Australian cinema, and I was just sniffing around in that genre, just in my own interest. I came across that because I heard that Nick Cave did a great turn in a minor role, and I would agree with that. He does a great turn in a minor role. My experience of it, this is maybe the third time I've seen it. First time I saw it, I was just kind of shocked. I just didn't really know how to digest it. And then I think I saw it again a few years later, and I really enjoyed it. And coming back to it now, I just feel it's so full of faults in terms of it's structured. It's like it's a narrative, but it's an ensemble piece. It's got a series of voiceovers, and it's recollection events which led up to a complete lockdown in what is already a maximum security prison. And as you say, it is very conspiracy theory. But here's the thing, okay. The first thing you get when you Google this is the website for the film, from like 2005, and this was released in 1988. And it's saying that this is based on real events. This is based on like biographies of prison guards and things like that. That was very heavily researched. So
that's just promo bluff.
And that's what it's saying. But I was looking up in the books it's based on. I was like, okay, so this is based on actual material. It's not just something they pulled out their ass.
No, it's based on a book by a murderer and
no, I do.
Some other work by a prison guard.
Yeah, the soundtrack, if you listen to it, has got like phone calls with the prison guard and stuff. But I agree with you. It's fluff, but it's intimidating. I didn't know if they just were like a really macabre imagination, they just pulled this stuff out, but the fact is based on real prisons. And you know, it's an accumulation of all the worst events and all the worst prisons put into one place. So I don't buy it as being a forecast of the future. I do definitely believe that the incarceration system, especially in America, is about money, and it's in their benefit to keep people scared and keep people coming to prison. But yeah, it's just a really creepy film, a really weird film, and it sits really uncomfortably with me. But I enjoyed it less because I feel like the structure just didn't hold up. Like, I got really confused as to what... And the film's divided into three severities of a maximum security prison. You got a general population, special population, and solitary confinement. And I got the general population and special population mixed up all the time, and I felt that was really significant. Like, these guys are bad, these are worse still. And the multiple narrators, and this is just me being a wee bit racist, is like, they just all sound Australian. So which Australian is talking to me now? Is this a guard or is it that prisoner? And I got confused quite a lot.
There's definitely like technical like obstacles to following everything straightforwardly. Whether they're, deliberate elements or it's unintentional flaws or, you know, deliberately making it difficult for you to get a coherent eye of what's going on. I agree with you. It's certainly something that's in place. For me, it didn't lessen the enjoyment. It adds to the sense of what a disruptive and distorted kind of structure it is, where it's very hard to fathom exactly who's talking about what and about who and what the motivations are for, you know, person X's action against person Y and so on. I mean, it's only the third time I saw it that I figured out that the reason that Wenzel goes and, you know, hits that guy and steals his radio is because the kind of money bags guy in the prison, Maycheck, you know, the one who's got the fancy room at the start of it, he's like had a word with him and said, "Oh, you get him and then we can take over." And I was like, "Oh, I never got that." And not because it's like a subtle thing, it's just like a really messy sound mix.
Yeah, I mean, the way yous are talking about it just now sort of, it gives me an avenue to come in and say that, like, certainly from, I mean, this was my first viewing of it, so I was kind of lost through quite a lot of it, but not in a way that I disliked. It was kind of trippy and cool, and I liked just hanging out in that place. It's got a really cool, ominous tone to it. Not that way, like, I mean, it's unpleasant, but it's not unpleasant in terms of, like, filmmaking. Like,
yeah, a dystopian vision in blue and mustard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's grim and nasty, but I like the place that it took me to. For as long as I was watching the film, I can't say that I came away with very much of a coherent thought about the film in terms of like discussing it thematically with you guys. I couldn't even really recall, you know, too many of the circumstances. I liked the, you talked about the multiple voiceover element to it, and yeah. I did like that. Eventually, at first, I thought it was kind of distancing and a little hard to get on board with. At least this viewing it. When you're listening to it, it eventually becomes like testimony, like recalled testimony during a inquiry or something like that, which makes it kind of interesting because it, although prisons are very much an environment of the here and now, you know, where it's about the intensity of being right in that moment and the visceral, you know, reality of having to deal with, you know, life and death situations on a knife edge, it adds a bit of perspective to it, which is kind of interesting. You know, the balance of, and the fact that it's actually quite a sort of, what's the word? Like a mournful voiceover as well, makes it seem like it's offering a perspective that's actually magnifies the grimness of the situation.
Yeah, I think it's a good film to kind of wallow in grimness. I mean, one of the things about prison movies that has interest is just this imagination of what's the worst things that can happen to people for the longest period of time and the most torment that a human could you know, have inflicted upon them. And there's tons of options in this film.
Absolutely. I mean,
that guy in solitary confinement is a tragedy. The one who talked about took a girl to a film at 16 once, felt her cunt, but never fucked one. And he thinks about sex, but he runs out of ideas.
Yeah, and all his dreams are about farms.
Farms?
Yeah, that's what he says.
I thought he said it was about violence and blood. Is this the sound mix playing with us again?
I'm sure he says farms.
I think violence and blood makes a lot more sense in terms of who this person is.
They're harsh time on the farm.
Maybe.
I mean, the one that gets me is after mega lockdown, and as it's put in the film, the corporation is trying to ramp things up and basically are playing with the lives of the prisoners and the guards to create more violence and more uproar and unrest, is the one where Maycheck is just ignored.
Oh yeah.
That the notion of that, of like being in a high security prison and then you're just ignored by everyone there, and you're not even like locked in your cell at night, and you're just like left to find somewhere to sleep. I mean, it's like Jesus Christ, you're like, you're homeless in prison. It's the cruelest thing I can imagine. And I've got to applaud it for finding something quite as depressing as that to put in there. But yeah, I think as far as, if you're looking for a prison movie to be, something that looks kind of cool and is very violent and has, lots of high tension and, high emotion, then it's certainly worth following up.
Yeah, I mean, and just as I was saying there about the fact that, well, I actually think I stumbled onto an idea there that was maybe an answer to Jack's earlier question about why are prison movies so appealing to people, and I think it is because they feel very much in the moment. Like, it's about you following literally, in the characters, literally. Do you know, actually, I can use the word literally, because the word literally, due to public demand, has been... the definition has been extended to include things that aren't literally true.
Figuratively.
That are figuratively true, which is insane. Apparently, the dictionary isn't so much supposed to be a document that gives you best practice with language. It gives you common parlance as well, which is insane.
My pet peeve on that is the word decimate. Decimate's supposed to mean destroy or kill 1 in 10, but it's used to insinuate decimate killing 9 out of 10. So that's my pet peeve, but
yeah. But do you know what I mean? Like, it's about you being in the moment with a character, and it's, there's a visceral quality to watching a prison film, because it's about how you're going to get by moment to moment. And what this film does really well is includes that, but actually balances it out as well with that sort of reflective quality. And I think I like a lot of the production design as well. I love those big, long, thin windows that are in a lot of the cells, and they look like sort of church windows or something medieval or something. Churches are like inherently places of reflection, because obviously every old church means to people nowadays is looking back on events from thousands of years ago. But that inclusion struck me as being really odd, and I do like the balance it achieves with its sort of in the momentness and its reflectiveness.
Can I ask you mentioned it being, I don't know if you were the word sci-fi or future. I don't think the movie ever verbally puts itself in any future beyond its filmmaking date. But I get what you're talking about. You got all that modernist architecture, the tunnels under the prison for some reason are like, Japanese subways. They're really sleek, with like the plastic archways.
Yeah, it never makes a claim to be, this is set in the year 20... .. It just seems to be an implication of the look and the sort of amplified alienation that the
Definitely it's an 80s vision of a future, you know, that way with like the automated female voice and like the scrolling text like the Terminator on you know, on a black screen. And
I mean, we do the same thing now. I mean I saw, I don't really want to talk much about it, but I saw that Stallone film Escape Plan, and they've got like this like colossal megaplex prison in there, and it's meant to be like really terrifying. You just think, this is what it'd be like if Amazon like owned prisons, maybe IKEA, but that's pretty much what it is. That's the kind of tone that it hits. It's just like, yeah, we've got resources to imprison everyone.
Is it worth seeing?
Barely.
It's on Instant, isn't it? It's on Amazon Instant.
Yeah, it's a big silly prison film. It's just about Arnie and Stallone getting together and you know, reliving past glories and you know, hitting people and you know, occasionally grabbing a gun, and then halfway through you go, fucking hell, that's Jim Caviezel. I didn't realise that's Jim Caviezel.
How does Schwarzenegger visually compare to Stallone? Because Stallone's still a big guy, like he's still like a tank, isn't he? Schwarzenegger's kind of just a bit doughy now.
Yeah, but when they're actually on the screen together, you're still like, it's still made clear that Schwarzenegger could take him
if he really
wanted to. You know, if we're going there in a prison movie.
Yeah, for sure. That'd be a much more interesting, like if Stallone had Schwarzenegger on a leash for like...
that would be a far more challenging film. That would like, ruin a lot of people's Saturday nights. Let's go see the new Arnie film. Was not prepared for that.
Yeah. I was interested in the way that, aside from Stallone's comeback career, or Schwarzenegger's comeback career, which I'm kind of interested in, but that's a conversation for another time. You're talking about the production design, just the level of pastel colours used in the prison to still make it look hellish was really weird, like somewhere between IKEA and like a prison movie again. There's like, I remember the inside of the cells when we went to, they stripped the artist of all his stuff and did a really rough anal cavity search and put him back in his cell, and it's pink and he's just wearing blue and he's just there with that sort of centre framing, and you see that really thin window, and you realise at that point like this entire environment has been painted as a sort of like pseudo-psychological effect to calm people with pastels, but it somehow looks oppressive. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean, there's almost a sort of doctor's surgery quality to it, if you know what I mean, or like a hospital, where everything, there's an aspect of that level of pastel on stone that just makes it look, I mean, if it looks like anything, it just looks not like home. You know, it looks like a place of procedure, you know?
Hmm. Was that the only one to get mixed up between the characters? I mean, I thought they cast them well, like, that guy looks like that. None of the two of them got mixed up for me visually, but I still got like, what the hell, what's going on here?
I think when it comes to actually following who's speaking in the voiceovers and who's done what to who and who's motivated, there's kind of moments of clarity that you kind of feel like you've caught up, and then there's other bits that you sort of try and backtrack with and figure out what was happening. But yeah, I think it's pretty deliberately structured. To leave you being a bit off kilter.
That's just, I mean, I was, if I was ever following the narrative, then I feel like it was, you know, 1 in 5 or, you know, 20% of the time that I was watching the film. But I think it is more just an expressive mood piece than anything else, and if it's not entirely coherent, then that's completely intentional.
Yeah, and seeing as they have, you know, set out to depict this place as being a, you know, designed to, you know, foster disruption and chaos and fear and violence, and then send it out into the world, then
and even if you can't work out exactly what it's trying to say, the fact that it does make a kind of sense by the time it ends to you, even if it's just a sort of emotional sense, then that's sort of enough.
I would agree with that. I just, like I say, a third time watching it, it's like, I don't know if it's intentional or not, but yeah, I'd be convinced it was intentional just from here to talking about it that way. It's just strange coming back to it a third time and feeling it's not often I come back to a film I had such a strong reaction to and then feeling confused about it on a second or third viewing, so that was an unusual experience for me. Okay, so I enjoyed this movie. I definitely recommend you listen to the soundtrack on its own. And I wanted to say one more thing. Watch it on YouTube, so I'll post it on the Tumblr. And I don't fetishize VHS, but it was clearly a VHS transfer. And I'm looking at it thinking, I can't imagine this in Blu-ray. I can't imagine this clean and clear. And do you know what I mean? I think like the medium at that point, you know, filtered through YouTube, but a VHS, it's just weird. It was like, this is the medium for this movie.
I would agree. Like, there's an aspect of VHS feeling a little more tailor-made, if you know what I mean. Like, a little less mass-produced, and that you could just have your own copy of this VHS film, and there need not have been another one in existence anywhere. That sort of gets lost with the mass production of Blu-ray and DVDs, but this film feels like a very singular experience as you're watching it. Like, it feels like something that almost hasn't been manufactured by artists, but just exists. So you're almost watching it, you know. How do I even begin to describe the feeling? I would leave it at saying that it feels like a singular experience as you're watching it, and VHS is more of a singular medium than the mass production of DVD and Blu-ray. So yeah, it seems to be a cozy fit.
I didn't find
fit.
Myself like longing for, you know, a nice, you know, clean, clear transfer.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a bit of reading, and I think the website for the movie said that they were going to do like a kind of special edition, like DVD and stuff, but that's like 10 years ago, and yes. There's the odd DVD, I think, available on like Amazon if you want to spend like £60 or something, but it's clearly not been, you know, distributed or, you know, reformatted or so on for you know, modern tech. But
and I think
just now I don't think it really needs it.
No, if it was redistributed on DVD, then I wouldn't notice the fact that, you know, I have this feeling that it does feel like inappropriate to release it on DVD. If it was actually released, then I'm sure I would be perfectly happy with that. One film that it actually did remind me of, have you guys seen any of Richard Stanley's work, like Hardware or something like that? I think is he another Aussie director?
I think you're... No, he's an American.
Is he American?
Yeah, but he does have that kind of Australian B-movie
vibe.
Dust Devil
as well?
I only remember seeing the trailers for Hardware, again, back in like the old VHS, you know, kind of stuff. Never actually got around to seeing the film.
But I think that's another sort of sensory film where you're just sort of watching it and being overcome by the music and the visuals and stuff like that. It's a certain type of filmmaker that I do find very appealing. And I think it does tap into that feeling of being like a singularity, like you and the film, and nothing else in the world happening. It's really cool. If you can find a filmmaker like that, he's worth hanging on to. But I don't think, did John Hillcoat ever approach this type of, I'm going to call it just sensory filmmaking again? I mean, I don't think The Proposition was anything like that. I don't think The Road was very much like that either. They all seem to be sort of plot-driven dramas.
I mean, there's a big gap in his, you know, in his career as far as making this feature and then going off to do, like, I think a lot of music videos and, you know, ad work and so on, very successfully, and then coming back to feature films. But yeah, there's a huge difference between, you know, Lawless and this. You know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I wonder why he sort of lost that impulse, because I can't imagine it's... I mean, I'm not massively familiar with Nick Cave's music, but I think certainly the later films that he's involved with writing, they become more wordy and they become more about the drama that's playing out. I don't know if his music took a similar turn and moved away from sort of moody, atmospheric stuff and more into sort of lyrical, you know, intellectual stuff. Is that fair?
No, it's always played kind of both ways, I think, with Nick Cave. There's always been the kind of intellectualism and then the kind of, you know, the grunting and hooting and the Stagger Lee side of things.
Mm.
As far as Hillcoat's concerned, I mean, this film was entirely self-funded. Ghost was entirely self-funded, so there was no studios involved in it, so he just got to do his own thing. And I think I don't really know how that would be pitched in America, you know? Like, what have you done? I've done this really existential, horribly, like, you know, perverse prison movie. Gonna give you that Cormac McCarthy thing that won the Pulitzer Prize? Gonna? No? All right. So, I don't know how he was going to get on in America like that, but I'd say that, I mean, even The Road as a Book is like a, is more of a, similar to the experience as Ghosts as a film, but as you know, The Road as a film was nowhere near Ghosts. It's completely different in tone. Yeah, are we, did you want to move on? Because I feel like I'm going to go off on a tangent here about literature at one point if I don't put a damp on it.
No, that sounds good.
Yeah, I think I've said most of what I want to say about this. Yeah.
One of our French double whammies, then.
Yeah. Well,
what do you want to take first? Do you want to take Le Tru or A Man Escaped?
I'd rather take A Man Escaped first, I think.
Okay. Well, go on then. Give us a synopsis, Nick.
Well, this is going to be the easiest synopsis of all time, apart from any of the intricate details of exactly why he's been arrested. I assume
if anyone's seen an episode of Alo, yeah, you can follow the history and politics of A Man Escaped.
So anyway, he's locked up, and the story is about him, his attempt to escape, and it couldn't be any more or less simple than that. And the film dramatizes, you know, his meticulous efforts to get out of this prison. Jack, did your headset come out or something?
It did, sorry.
Okay. So yeah, it's very straightforward. Did you guys have a particularly strong reaction to it one way or another?
Fucking hated it.
Wow.
This is interesting. Jack?
I saw it first time about a year ago, really loved it. Second time around, I felt a bit more lukewarm, but I'm going to have to go with Martin for an opener here. Like, I've never heard you so violent and since I made you watch, we won't mention that film. You hated Man Escape? Go on.
Yeah. I watched it 2.5 times.
What, in preparation for the show?
Yeah, I gave it some. I gave it a full go. The half time was watching it on 1.5 times speed to see if changing the pace of it would make it any more bearable. I don't know why they bothered making this a film. It's just a list. It's just a list of things happened. There's no attempt to add any interest to a scene, any layer to a scene. I mean, I understand the kind of the push behind it, the theory to strip away what's unnecessary and to try and leave things as, you know, stark that can speak for themselves. I just found it a crushingly dull experience. I really did. There's not one element of the film that I can say I really enjoyed or appreciated. I don't object to the way the images were framed. That's as positive as I can get.
Oh my goodness.
It was just a pointless endeavour. The actors are fundamentally incapable. The director doesn't want them to act, he just wants them to be there. The movement of scenes is, I never felt claustrophobia or cramp. I just felt that nothing was happening. That it was just it'll feel cramped if we don't move the camera over so we can just turn it up a bit. As for the sound, there are sounds of, you know, a town outside a prison. The narration drove me absolutely nuts. Just having everything that had just happened described to you by the narrator, that killed me. It was a horrible, horrible experience. Last week I watched a wee program about John Ford, and it had a bit with John Wayne on it. And John Wayne says, you know, about John Ford, you know, he didn't just tell a story, he wrote a poem about it. He didn't just point the camera at it, you know, he painted a painting, he made a picture. This is just something that's had a camera pointed at it. It's just a list of events that's had a camera pointed at it. And, oh my god, It was hard work, and I went and read up on what people thought about the film, and honestly, all I found was just all these people congratulating it for what wasn't in it. And I just think if you're pals with a bunch of really influential film critics in the 50s, you get a free ride to make a really shit film and have everyone say it's great. It sucks. It's like this all-time classic that's rated, you know, so highly by so many people that I admire. And I'm sitting there just like looking at it, just like, this is a calamity. I can't think of anything nice to say about this. And why does Tarkovsky care about this guy?
Does Tarkovsky care about this guy?
Yeah, loves him. But yeah, I mean, I understand people like it, and I'm interested to hear why, especially when it jars so much against what I experienced. But yeah, there was no part of it where I thought this is good or I'm not completely bored to tears. Everything about it is bad. Nothing. Even like the end of it, I didn't feel any sense of triumph. I felt no sense of peril whatsoever. There's some people that get shot, but it doesn't matter that they get shot. I never felt anything. Nothing at all. Even like when they're over the side of the building and Mozart swells up, I'm just like, you didn't earn that. You didn't earn that music with your film. It just, all of it left me really unmoved.
See, this is interesting. I think I will arrive at a sort of similar conclusion to you, but Jack, I just wanted to hear, you said that you loved it initially and maybe this time you were a little bit more lukewarm to it.
I made a really considered effort to see a couple of Robert Bresson films. Year or so, I would start with The Pickpocket, and I felt something similar to Martin in terms of The Pickpocket. Like, I do not fucking get why anyone would watch this movie. It's just the deadness in the performance, moving through it, the voiceover just gnawed at me. So I stopped halfway through. I think that movie's only an hour. I stopped halfway through it. I couldn't take it. And then I got pissed off at myself that this movie defeated me. Not that it, you know, that happens a lot, but the fact that it was only an hour, I was like, I couldn't even make it through an hour. Like, oh, fuck this, I'm going to watch it. So, saddest second time, I was like, you know what, I can see the appeal, but there was just something about that environment, you know, there was a pickpocket, he was in a love affair, and he was ignoring his mother, and he was just a sad sack, expressionless person. And to me, it's like, I don't understand how you can have that flat and emotional reaction to what's happening in your life, and it didn't make sense to me. And then I was looking around and I realized that based on critical reception, that Man Escape was more highly accepted. It's like, well, you know, I want to see this too. And in knowledge, you know, reading around this time that all these actors were like that. And then at the same time, I'm thinking, well, this is like, you know, as we said, like a really high drama environment. How is this going to play out? But the fact it was a French resistance prisoner war movie, and the fact he was essentially in a death sentence, he had this sort of really blank sense of acceptance that he was going to die. And that is what made the performance kind of acceptable to me in watching it. And you're talking about how it's just a list of actions. I really like procedural things happen in movies, like in the same way that Gravity is about, I need to get to here, or I'm going to die. I do enjoy that, and the fact that there is, I'll admit it's almost banal, but doing that with cinema, where you can follow it, where it's not just panning a camera and watching someone pick up a pen or something like that, and putting some kind of stakes behind it, that's the kind of cinema that I get a kick out of. So I remember watching it and thinking that was just really strange, because it was just stripped of all emotion. I think the highest emotional point in the movie is he figures out the kids he's sharing a flea with, you know, once sharing a cell with had fleas, and he goes, really? And then, you know, he scrunches his brow. He's like, oh, he scrunched his brow. It's like, you know,
at least he didn't look off sadly, kind of down into the side, because that, oh god, that got me. if you're gonna go for the actor is just a model, tell him to do nothing, leave it inscrutable. Don't give me wee sad looks off to the side. I just, oh god.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? It's actually really refreshing to hear someone trash this movie, because looking around, it was just praise upon praise, and this is coming from someone. I still quite enjoyed it, but the second viewing, I think it was dramatically decreased. And looking back on the first viewing, I think I enjoyed it just because of how procedural it was, and the lack of music. But the character interactions especially, I mean, that's what dragged it away from being an excellent film the first time I saw it, is the character interactions were just like, are you talking to one another right now? Or are you just sort of like, is your just internal dialogue just seeping out of your mouth? You know, but honestly, really refreshing if you trash it. I'm actually tempted just to skip Nick and ask you to say more, but I think you're out of steam right now.
Well, I mean, I
the only thing that's left is just to say that I just thought the whole thing just seemed like a director's vanity project in the worst way. It's like, I mean, I guess he was in with that whole Cahiers de Cinema crowd of critics, and you know, auteur theory came around, you know. Around then, and this is just like, yeah, that's what I want to be. I want to be the boss and have everything look exactly like I want it to look. And nah, I just, that, I fucking hate him. I mean, I watched that shit twice. I bought that fucking thing on DVD, so it wasn't going to get any, like, you know, dodgy subtitles and have anything to detract from it. I gave it every opportunity to show me something, and it's just a dismal, dismal, nasty film, and I don't understand why anyone would ever like it.
Okay.
On to you.
Right. Your reaction actually lends me some assistance in terms of actually working out my views on the film. So, at first I really liked it. I thought it was really refreshing. I liked the sort of cool, detached tone that it had. And it sort of felt like it was really kind of embracing the attitude of the main character, that sort of cool French reserve, like the sort of the 50s thing you said, like the Cahiers de Cinema, like the sort of Godard characters that would come around in the 60s.
Yeah, this film needs a Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Yeah.
It really does.
And I kind of liked that he wasn't hyper distressed about his situation, because there was an aspect of it maybe not feeling productive. Like, if he was to be hyper-distressed, then he wouldn't really be efficient at being able to escape. And the fact that it just streamlined that and said, like, I have my goal and I've got my eyes fixed on it and I'm not moving from it was kind of cool to me. I liked that quite a bit. And at first I was kind of latched on to his internal dialogue, which sort of added a little bit of colour to the film, which was otherwise completely dry. But his inner monologue has a sort of emotion to it. He talks about very, very coldly about how emotionally he was feeling on the inside. Like, you can only feel emotionally on the inside. But he would talk about how distressed he was, or how happy he was, or elated, or depressed. But he would never show it himself. And I thought it was kind of interesting for what it was, and I sort of latched onto it. But sooner or later, I just realised, like, I'm fed up. You know, like, I'm not actually feeling anything here. As much as, like, I would have loved to. I actually did fall asleep at one point during the film. Not for very long, but there was a moment where I nodded off, and then I came back to, and I was sort of having to pinch myself to stay awake for a lot of the film. There's things that you can latch onto that are interesting. I like the stuff with the two different woods on the door and being able to, you know, mask the stuff that you're doing. I like the fashion of the rope out of, I guess, there's like horse hair and wire. And
just
stuff
made
like
me
that.
Think that, like, why are these guys so bad at having a prison?
Yeah,
I know. I mean,
even making, like,
why have they left so much material around? Yeah.
Make the chisel out the spoon, you know, stuff like that is cool. But again, its aesthetic is just too dry, and it's just an intellectual experience for me at the end when the credits roll. I never feel anything, and that may not necessarily be too bad a thing. I'm sure we talked about how deliberate the sort of distance and stuff is in Ghosts of the Civil Dead. I'm sure, I mean, I know for a fact that the decisions made in this film are completely intentional.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, Like, this is, I actually think it'll be helpful for me to talk, because it was helpful to me in understanding the way I felt about the film, to watch Le Trou and be able to work out, because both films are very similar in terms of their approach to one particular topic, but one film for me succeeded massively more than the other. And I would say, like, I walked away from this film with quite a lot of respect for the filmmaker. Like, I think the way he uses, I think historically what's been important about this film is his use of sound. I think there's a quote that he had firing about that said, like, what was it? Noise without visuals makes the eyes impatient, and visuals without sounds makes the ears impatient. And he says, use those impatiences when you're making films. But again, it's all intellectual, and by the time you're at the end of the film, like, I was completely numb. I was feeling well rested after my brief sleep earlier on, but other than that, it was like complete neutrality. And when the film ended, it ended, and I was quite happy to see the back of it. I mean, I gave it a good review out of respect, but I think I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that, like, I'm not really here as, like, a professional critic to say that this is a fabulous piece of art that needs to be preserved for posterity, and we need to be advising people that this is a work of significance. It's about how we feel, like, when we finish a film. That's all that we really have to offer.
Well, I think if you'd be familiar with my stance on Chaplin. So,
yeah.
At no point do I detract from his historical role or his technical ingenuity and pushing things forward, but I don't want to watch his films.
Yeah, it's remarkable that you can make a prison film and not have it be visceral in any way, shape or form. You know, it takes some true skill to remove any sense of jeopardy from the film.
I mean, I understand it as a purposeful and thought out intent. That's what he wanted to do, but I have no interest in it and I have no time for it.
Okay. Agreed. I mean, like I say, I can't argue against that, and it's not my place to, because I can't say I had much of a better experience with it. I'm sure that we sound like Luddites for saying that, and that, you know, there's any number of professional critics who could explain to us in no uncertain terms why it's a work of such significance. But
I'll
just
stab them in the eye with a rusty spoon.
It's just not my business to be interested in anything like that. You know, this is about how we feel after watching it, and that's the way we felt. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jack, would you have any additional thoughts about the film?
Just that, I mean, my gut reaction after a film is what I go with, but my gut reaction to the first time viewing this was that I did really enjoy it. And then coming back to it, it just felt like, wow, this is missing so much of what I first got out of it, that you start to question your first viewing. And actually, that's twice, and that happened with Ghost as well, and I said it doesn't happen often for me. So it's twice in quick succession in reviewing movies for this list. But I would say that I am interested in identifying films that are different or key in a development towards something, or you stand apart, even if they're not necessarily good. But I'd say it's less important than your immediate enjoyment, and that, you know, my dreams of academia are dead, and I've embraced that. But I'm still interested in what was important historically at one point to see how it increases my enjoyment of other films. So I'm glad I've seen it. It's definitely different to any kind of acting style I've ever seen, but I think Martin hit the nail on the head in that it is like a director's ego project. You can't speak about anything in this film apart from direction. There's no acting to be spoken of. There's no set design to be spoken of in highly. Even the script, like you say, it is just a list. It's pure direction. So that in itself is somewhat admirable, and like, wow, you are a very good director. But then it's like completely cynical in that, you know what, film's a collaborative process. You really should have let someone else say something at some point during this production. You just imagine him treating his, like, his set design the same way he would his actors. Like, no, don't say anything. No, just look sad. Turn right. Okay, we're done. And then walking away. So I would take that as, like, an ideal criticism of this film and of the three films I've seen potentially this director. I'm interested in how you thought it was different from Le Trou. I want to go with Martin first again, because you hated this. How do you think of Le Trou?
I really liked it. I thought it was a really good film. I mean, it's a few months since I've seen it. I was going to rewatch it again for this, but ran into a technical hitch and wasn't feeling well, and it just kind of cut down on the time available to go and go and watch it again. But it was such a different experience. I think prisoner of war films are a bit different from prison movies.
Yeah, I completely agree.
I think that threw it a bit for me, even just in terms of the themes, because with a prisoner of war film, more often than not, your hero, the protagonist, is faultless. Mm. You know, he's been held by the enemy, and he's been fighting for good, and everything's been. So I heard something.
It's me. It's my shoe squeaking.
Oh, right, okay. So it removes that that element of identification with someone that you shouldn't identify with.
Mm.
Again, the kind of thing where it's, you know, empathy with murderers and feeling bad for someone who's done dreadful things either in the past or through the narrative. But yeah, I like the detail of Littreau. I mean, it makes French prisons seem quite a comfy, kind of cosseted sort of place, but it still has an instinct for what offends people and would hurt them and would strip them of their rights and their humanity. Like, if you watched a prison movie now and it was a guard going through someone's food and tearing apart, artisanal cheeses and salamis to find contraband, you'd be like, but they're French. That's what they care about,
Yeah.
That imagery of someone just like rifling through and destroying, the only kind of treat from home that you have, the thing that brings you and your prisoners together, you and your like kind of co-prisoners, I guess. Is that how you'd say it?
Cellmates.
Yeah.
Co-prisoners? Yeah, it sounds odd. Yeah. You and your cellmates, that'll work. The thing that brings you and your cellmates together is food. It's a little bit of ritual. You see it in all kinds of prison movies where they have their cups of tea and their kettles and stuff like that. So yeah, to have the guards like tearing through just that little bit of something that represents your humanity, I thought that was really powerful. Visually, it's what you want from a kind of like French impressionist movie of that time. It's just it's beautifully put together. Everything's got lots of contrast to it and a real dynamism in the imagery. It's that the actual like physical escape, it felt like the loudest film I'd ever seen. If you want to talk about the value of sound design and using it to create atmosphere and tension, it was just like, shh, they'll hear you, you're being really 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 loud, don't do it, you're going to blow it. I'd want to show it as like a kind of counterpoint, kind of like to put Rififi and Littreau on a double bill together.
Absolutely.
So you've got like the quietest scene ever where you're like, don't make a single sound, and then you've got this where they're just like leather and fuck out of the walls.
I did get huge enjoyment from that. I mean, people were talking about it online and I didn't really understand it, but the whole escape act in Littreau is that at one point they tear up the floorboards from the corner of the cell. They make a tool out of one of the beds, just by taking one of unscrewing a bolt basically, and then proceed to smack the shit out of the concrete until there's a hole. And it holds that shot for like 2 or 3 minutes until you're like, no. Like, this is gonna work. They're gonna get through.
Yeah, it's incredible. You are literally watching people smash through a concrete floor, and it is astonishing to see, like, just the perseverance of it, of the smashing repeatedly until you're turning the floor into, like, bits of rubble, and then eventually cracking through to the other side is just incredible to see.
I think the preferred part for sheer volume is when they're in the tunnel.
Yeah.
And then you've got the echo effect into it as well. And you're just like, the whole building must be hearing this.
Yeah.
So, Jack, I trust that you had a pretty positive reaction to the film as well.
I was worried looking back on it that I might find it really cheesy. Things like when they break through the floor, they're in underground catacombs. And that's a cliche of, you know, Paris and France, but it's true. I mean, the whole city's just sitting on, you know, miles and miles of catacombs, and buildings have basements that have been there for hundreds of years. And the piece where they're just so capable. It's like we have this little tiny piece of a mirror, you know, this piece of metal, and it was just a bit, I thought it would be campy going back on it. Like, it's very convenient you managed to do that with this little mirror. Or it's very convenient you managed to make a key of a piece of metal because you have this file. But looking back on it, it's like, no, I think that desperate people find ways to get out of the environment that they're in, and it still felt believable. One scene in particular where they're in underground and they pause for a second because they hear guards coming, and it's like a room with a pillar in the middle, and to hide it, there's two people wide, so they can't hide behind the pillar, so one stands on the guy's shoulders and they shuffle around it. And it's thinking about that without seeing it again, looking back on it, it's like, hang on, that was cheesy as fuck. But looking at it, it's like, you know what, that worked. That whole scene worked so well. So, like, it's still convincing. I watched it like an hour ago before I called you guys because I was desperate to get it in. Just to see. I think I could have missed, you know, ghosts. I think I could have missed that and had, like, an opinion on it. But I'd only seen Latrobe once, and I wanted to be sure how I felt about it. And it's a really good movie. What gets me, and this is, like, true of all three films, you know, Ghosts tentatively tend to be based on something. Man Escape was based on something. And Latrobe was based on something. So there's always, like, elements to truth for all three. But the big seller for Latrobe is that the sequence where, you know, it pans round and there's a guy working on a motor, and he looks surprised to see you and comes towards the camera and talks to you. Like, my name is Gaspar. The director made this film about me, and that happened in 1947. And then you see him in the scene and you realise he's not playing himself, he's playing someone else in the cell. And that tension between someone who claims to be, have been there, but playing another role, really sold me on, you know, just the whole dynamic between all four characters. I thought it was really strange, but really successful. I just wanted to know what you thought about that.
What about him specifically being in the film?
Just the fact that, you know, someone foregrounds himself as, like, I was here, this happened, my friend the director made this movie. And then you see him again.
Oh, no, go on.
Just, did you feel like it gave it anything?
I think it does help to balance out that aspect that you talk about of it maybe feeling a little bit cartoony at times, which I didn't necessarily feel in the moment, but I think that was largely in part or largely due to the fact that this guy was involved. Like, sorry, Martin's just seems uncomfortable.
Yeah, I'm just like totally giving myself like a minor hamstring strain.
So you're right. Do you need to escape?
Just need to like stretch my leg and then.
Do you need a massage?
That's what the cupboard's for.
Yeah, that's.
No, it's just one of those like weird things. It's just like when you've been sick and then you haven't been like moving around very much, and it's like all residual like aches and pains. And I just tensed my leg for a second, and then the whole muscle just went. So yeah.
Okay.
Carry on. Cool. I'm no longer in crippling pain.
Well, no, all I was saying was that like. If there was any chance of it feeling dopey or cartoony, then that bloke's presence certainly does add a weight to it and makes it all the more believable. And I don't know that I necessarily see any value beyond that, but I don't think it necessarily needs to have that value. I think it's there at the beginning and it's amusing actually at the beginning. And then through the course of the film, you could forget that he's present, and I don't think it necessarily detracts. I mean, did you have any particular feeling about his involvement?
Not especially, in all honesty. I mean, I took it for all it was, which was just an introduction into it. But
yeah, it was fun, wasn't it? It was like it was amusing and charming.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like the thing I appreciated most about this film was that there was a sense of threat, and there was a sense of the people in the plot together having something really at stake.
Yeah.
It's a complete contrast to A Man Escaped, which is a fait accompli from the outset, and there's no attempt to generate any, like, you know, false, you know, stress for the viewer. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I really liked that you had, you know, the group with the plan ready to go, and then it just throws this guy into their midst.
Mm.
And you're like, well, on you go, deal with that now that, you know, everything's set up for your grand plan, and now there's someone new, and you have to decide, you involve him, you trust him, or you give up, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say I loved the film. Like, I thought it was awesome. And I think, like, I mean, it's actually quite comparable with The Man Escaped, as I say, like, just in terms of the fact that it doesn't feel like there's a particularly massive threat from the group themselves and the other inmates. I mean, there's an altercation at one point after a theft, but it isn't as if, you know, the threat isn't how do I survive in this place, mm-hmm. it's just how do I get out. And, you know, how do I do so without the guards spotting me? So there's that aspect, again, of, like, one of the integral qualities of the prison film being stripped away. But it obviously doesn't suffer from that in the same way that I think A Man Escapes suffers. I think, first of all, because it recognises that the kind of fun that you can have with the ragtag team as opposed to the individual on his own. Mm-hmm. And I think the team themselves are a lot of fun. And it's really fun being introduced to all of them. And you get to know their individual characters straight away. Their dialogue's a lot of fun. Like I say, I love their ritualized sort of eating and drinking.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the hanging out with them is an awful lot of fun. I think the film has a really great textural focus. Like even when they're eating, or when, like you say, the artisanal cheeses and the sausages are being chopped up, you get this great chomping sound effect when they're being split open and cut, and even like the guy cutting up bread for the other prisoners, and he seems to be like orbiting the bread with his knife, like, or it's maybe it's like a straight spoon. Razor is it a back of a spoon. I didn't know
not
if it was that
knives,
or like,
yeah.
No, I didn't know if it was like a shaving razor or something like that, but then they get shaved later by someone else, so it's a spoon that he digs in and sort of swivels around the thing. That's great. And I mean, you could also include in that sort of textural thing, like the smashing up of the floor and watching it crumble and then come into bits. It's a film that feels very worldly. Like, there's stuff you can feel, and like it affects your senses watching it in a way that thinks it's really cool. And, you know, I loved just the ideas in the film. It feels so clever so much of the time. Like, even, I mean, the plan itself, I think, smart. I think the ideas, like the way that they use the glue bottle as a lantern, and the way that they pass messages between the cells with spinning like a bit of string, and then what do they hold out? They hold out like
the brush for the brush and pan.
Yeah, like a brush and pan to catch it, then spin it round and you know to pass on to the next cell along. And then you've got like the hourglass that they make out of two test tubes. Or something like that. It's just every idea that comes up just is such a pleasure, and it's so much fun to watch them overcome obstacles. I don't think I've felt this kind of enthused by the kind of ideas that were being presented to me in a film in such a long time. It's just like the best example I can use is one of my favourite things that I see in films is there's a really good scene in The Maltese Falcon where I take it you've both seen The Maltese Falcon.
Yeah.
It's Bogart and Sidney Greenstreet, and they're both kind of up against each. I think, is it Gutman in The Maltese Falcon? and they're both kind of up in each other's face in theory, but they're actually both playing it really cool. And eventually, like, you're watching these two guys attempt to outclass each other in terms of coolness, but they're both competing against each other. But eventually Bogart goes mad at him, stands up and starts shouting, and starts, you know, drops the facade, and he stomps out of there, and you think, oh, what has he done? Like, he's gone and blown it. Like, this was his opportunity to, you know, be smooth and as calculated as we know he can be, but he just fucked it all up. But as he's walking away and stomping out, he suddenly slows down his walk and smirks as if it was planned the whole time. And it's that trick in writing where you can just be one step ahead of the audience and play them that way. And I think there's, just to watch a writer outsmart you repeatedly with, like, solutions to problems that you hadn't even conceived of, or, like, problems that you didn't necessarily think would exist, but not only did they recognise that the problem existed, but they've got the solution immediately, is just incredibly satisfying to watch. Even, like you were saying, the two, one on top of the other's shoulders, because you hadn't even noticed the fact that this pillar was too narrow to have two of them, you know, hide behind it. Mm-hmm. Is just so fantastic and adds so much fun watching this film that it really did help me in coming to the conclusion that I did about A Man Escaped, which, if you'll allow me, like, I think you're totally right in saying that it's a director's film and saying that it's a film about ideas. I think what A Man Escaped is to me is, like, it's a film that uses film or uses cinema or uses storytelling to try and satisfy the whims of an artist, you know, to try and present ideas, whereas Littrow takes ideas and takes, you know, the artistic vision and tries to craft it into a film and says, like, the film is the main thing and it's about making a film that's palatable and enjoyable to watch, as opposed to, you know, the Man Escaped, which is to take film and try to make an intellectual exercise out of it. And there's a very fine line, but it's one that I think struck me quite, you know, like it struck me like a sledgehammer when I was watching A Man Escaped, where I was saying, like, this is exactly what's wrong. When I was watching Littrow and saying, this is exactly what's wrong with A Man Escaped. I mean, would you guys agree that this film places more of an emphasis on storytelling than it does, like, even though its ideas are excellent, they're all in service of a bigger story, whereas A Man Escaped takes the story and then tries to use it to express ideas?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you've summed it up very well. I don't think there'd be much to be gained by me reiterating what you've said, because I pretty much agree with it fundamentally.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty is that I feel like what I'm saying is that one is more entertaining than the other, and while that could be true, there's kind of a resistance that everyone tends to have when you start congratulating films for being entertaining, because film's quite a pretentious medium and it doesn't want to think of itself as being kind of dumb entertainment. It wants to think of itself as being higher in terms of, like, being able to express, you know, the answer big questions.
No, I mean, the self-worthiness of Man Escaped, you know, just shines through. It's patently obvious. I prefer to have a film that's, you know, meant for an audience to actually appreciate. Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of room for manoeuvre within those, you know, sort of those ends of the spectrum. But I think even just accepting that A Man Escaped is classified as a kind of a director's indulgence and more a theoretical kind of exercise, and a technical exercise, I think it's a really fucking awful one.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think there are people that could do far more stimulating. I never got a sense of, here's a director's mind that I want to know. Here's a director's mind that I wish I could get to a level where I was really, like, understanding the depth of what he's doing. I felt the whole thing was really shallow.
That's a really good word that you used in terms of being stimulating, because as much as I can tell the worthiness of the film, as I was watching it, I really wasn't being stimulated. It's so much so that I fell asleep, as I say. But, like, it's kind of a reaction that you wouldn't tolerate in most other art forms. Like, it's difficult because it's not really comparable to a lot of other art forms, but if you were talking about food criticism or something like that, you wouldn't stand for a dish that was intellectually stimulating but not palatable. Like, that would be absurd. The same with like art criticism. If something wasn't immediately stimulating and was kind of intentionally bland, or all technique and without hitting you on a visceral level, you wouldn't tolerate it either. But in film, it's kind of, we're lost in the pretentiousness of cinema. There's kind of I noticed it quite a lot when I was studying film for 2 years with you guys, that like a lot of the articles you would read were just like unfathomable, because it was almost like an attempt to make it seem, to make cinema seem worthy of this level of thought, where I could read a whole paragraph from, you know, an academic journal. I would actually read it to people for comedy, because it was completely, you know, it was a collection of words that meant absolutely nothing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I understand how you feel. I think when you've got an art form and criticism of an art form that are comparatively in their infancy, there's that desire to establish, and one of the ways to try and do that is to obscure it and to make it seem inaccessible, and it requires the higher minds such as myself to use words such as Lacthusarian to help, you know, the peons understand more about this thing. And in actuality, you're just like, why are you doing this to me? Why are you inventing words out of two completely unrelated theorists' names and then positing that as something new to help me understand? Yeah. It doesn't.
See, that's one of the things about when I switched to law. It's like, it was so, the emphasis switched, where before I felt like people were trying to make film more complicated than it had to be, whereas in law, it was about, we know that these are difficult concepts, so our role is to simplify them to the point where we can actually have a discourse about them. And I think that that attitude is certainly much more appealing to me, even though the concepts may have been incredibly difficult. The fact that we were all working to simplify them to the point of, you know, having a capable discourse was just so much more helpful to me than the other way around. But I'm interested to hear Jack, because Jack's been silent on this, and I feel like Jack, you might have a kind of alternative opinion, if I'm reading you correct historically.
No, I'm just interested in hearing the both of you talk. I thought you were just being interesting. I would agree broadly with what you're saying. It's just that cinema does have this need to be taken seriously, this need to be something more than just, you know, a talkie, or even beyond that, than just a blockbuster. It's just that's most people's conception of cinema. And if I'm being completely honest with you, I get that. I understand that need to be taken seriously. This is like, no, I am more than a Michael Bay movie, or even I am more than like a Steven Spielberg movie. This is an art form. You have to take me seriously. I get into conversations a lot about, you know, my education, and it's embarrassing. And, you know, I did it to myself, but it's embarrassing. Like, so you studied film? It's like, yeah. So you want to make film? Like, no, I've no interest in making film. It's like, but you studied film? It's like, yeah, but I didn't study to make film. I studied film to study for its own sake, for its richness, for its contribution to society. And then there's this blank look on their faces, like, so you're an actor? Like, no. I have no interest in any direct, like, I studied it because I think it's worthy. And you know, that argument itself is like, it's worthy of study. It's hard to explain to people. So it's not in the popular mindset. Even my wife's job, she's an editor. And you and I, people who like films, understand what that means. But if you meet someone who watches films as something on the telly, or something their mates show them, and you tell them what an editor is, they'll ask you, what does she do? And you know, part of me, my fucking blood boils. It's like, you ignorant cunt, like, this is part of your life every day. You watch visual media every day and you don't know what an editor is? You don't know what that is? And then one step further, I was doing this class with these kids who were Boy Scouts. I was doing like a cinematography class, and we're talking about division of labour and how it's a collaborative process. And it's like, I want to be the director. It's like, okay, so why do you want to be the director? It's like, I like the chair. And that made me laugh. Okay, I like that. But then I started talking to him. He's like, so seriously, what does a director do? It's like, they make a lot of decisions on how something's filmed. It's like, I don't understand. And I had to explain it to him for a half hour. And, you know, not consistently, but he kept on calling me back. Like, I still don't understand what I'm supposed to be doing. It's like, well, this is just cinematographer. It's like, yeah, so you're going to tell him what to do? It's like, well, I don't know what I want him to do. It's like, well, that's why you have to know his job. It's like, well, why wouldn't I just be a cinematographer? And at one point, it's just like, I could feel the back of my hand rising up to slam down on him. You know? But these are things that you and me take for granted. We understand these roles. We understand what they mean. But the general population often don't. And like I say, like an editor, the fact that, you know, your sound would need editing for a film is... people just don't think about that at all. It's nowhere near consideration. The fact you can have a film without a fight scene in it, for some people, is ludicrous. And so to me, that's... I feel I need to defend it constantly. Admittedly, the lens that Film Academia goes to do that in making words, sentence structure, which boggles belief, a need to go towards continental European philosophy as a means to justify what it's doing, is too far. And I'd hope it would come out of that at one point, but I've got to be honest, I don't think it will. I think it's too ingrained in it now for the serious academic side of film to move beyond that. It's going to take a couple of really influential characters that aren't in film directly.
I think it needs time. I mean, I think the prime thing that stuck out as being really awkward for film criticism was that it latched on to so many different, more established theoretical areas of study to just for shits and giggles, really, just to try and make it seem more important. And when you try and like latch on to really, really pinpoint analysis and tricky concepts that have been applied to say linguistics, something that's been, you know, poured over and over and built, and then you just try and tack on, well, here's what this would be like if we're talking about, you know, Hollywood in the 50s. It doesn't work, and it just felt phony, you know? So I think there's plenty of people who feel that way, and I mean, I would expect there to be quite easily a kind of substantial, you know, generational change, and that people will generate their own ideas of what's important to them and why they look at it and why they study it and why they want to share it with people. And it won't just be, well, because, you know, because that's what they were doing in, you know, Freudian analysis of, you know, political systems in the 70s, so we did it to film as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I think the opposite is also a risk, though. Like, I do listen to podcasts quite a lot when I'm, like, either commuting or ironing or whatnot around the house. One trend that I'm noticing quite a lot is, like, I listen to one that... there's a sort of Scottish podcast on horror films, and I don't tend to listen to it very often because I generally find horror film podcasts a little bit infuriating, I think is the right word, because it's an audience that I don't really belong to. As much as I do love horror films, I'm not like a horror fanboy. I would never go to a horror film festival, ever. And the notion that horror films are like the be-all end-all, like I would just involve it as like a subgenre of cinema that I'm particularly fond of, but not to the, you know, exception of any other genre. But one thing that comes up is that this podcast that I listen to will play adverts for other similar podcasts, and at least two out of the four adverts that you'll usually play involve like, are you interested in listening to high-minded people talk intellectually about this subject? Well, you've come to the wrong fucking place, because we're here to have a good time. You know, I see all that shit where they just exclude the notion that there's anything intellectual to say about films and just instead go off on one about how much they love the tits or the blood and the gore and all that in these films, and to like a real celebration of, you know, the kind of indulgence that comes when you just embrace the entertainment aspect of cinema, as opposed to, you know, having a discussion like we do about maybe some of the more worthy points that could come up. Not to be too self-congratulatory, but I think that is a concern when you do completely distance yourself from the academic.
Touché. Yeah, I just agree with you. I mean, I still read film theory when I get a chance, but getting a chance to read film theory is getting a chance to read the same paragraph 4 or 5 times until you understand what the hell it's saying to you. So I understand people feeling that they're being pushed away from it. Martin, I hope you're right. I hope there's a generation that makes this more accessible and that it stands on its own without fear or, you know, a sense of inferiority. But I'm dubious that'll happen in my lifetime. I just don't know what's going to happen to it. It'd be great if it did.
People will need to feel richer before that happens. There's a degree of fear just now in the world about, you know, people's financial instability, and that feeds directly into, you know, university funding and the value of arts topics for study. So, I mean, there's so much insecurity in that area that I don't think it's happening, you know, 5-10 years time. But you know, like we say, I mean, it's a relatively fresh area for study, and given time and given depth, there's no reason that it can't, you know, so be somewhat redeemed from its more obscure leanings.
Yeah, I mean, this might just be a general art thing, because I'd said before that I didn't think art suffered from the same problem, but I actually just remembered last summer, Emma and I travelled down to Wales to visit a friend who was doing her degree show for a ceramics art class. It was a PhD she was doing, and we travelled down to spend some time with her and go to the show, and we walked around the installations, and like, unfathomable isn't the word to describe the, you know, the explanations, because you'd look at something and you'd feel, I mean, I always feel like a bit of a Philistine when I'm in an art gallery situation. So I would look to the explanation, what the artist was thinking, and it's usually included in a bit of paper by the side of the installation. And to read it was, you know, just as baffling as staring at the piece itself. I wish I could think of some examples, but it'd be probably rude to say any of them. But, you know, I mean, aside from the fact that, I mean, it sounds like I'm being overly nice, but, you know, the girl that we visited, her work was, you know, excellent, very self-explanatory. It didn't, you know, need a baffling array of words that had absolutely no meaning to me to justify its own existence. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a lot of what it is in academic institutions. It's a lot of people, you know, pleading the case that they were worthy for the additional funding that they got to do this course. You know, mm-hmm. that their work is worthy and it contributes something, and this is the niche area where it contributes something. And rather than have their work be judged by an outsider and say that is this worthy or isn't it, it's stressing its worth in, you know, a way that can't really be argued against, because no one has an idea what the fuck you're talking about in this little blurb by the side of your project.
Yeah.
You have to assume worthiness because you're not intelligent enough to know any reference point that they're making and challenge them in any of the decisions that they've made.
Mm-hmm. I try and spend a lot of time in art galleries. I like art a lot. The LA art scene is like a fresh of breath air, and like in terms of conversation.
Fresh of breath air?
Nothing else in LA is a breath of fresh air apart from art galleries. It's all very smoggy. But the early art scene is very...
I don't think he's picked up that he said the wrong words in the right place. And so.
Did you say them wrong twice? Am I hearing them wrong now?
We did get a fresh of breath there, yeah.
Okay. I thought it would be a bad pun about LA weather or LA air quality, but not even that. Whatever. The early art scene is very pop art, you know, based on comic books, or, you know, people might have a higher education, but it's not like a blue line and a white canvas, you know, and there's 4 of those in a gallery and they're for thousands of dollars. It feels really accessible, and there's no need for a blurb. What you're talking about there, that blurb on the side, that doesn't exist. It's just, you know, it's a price tag, and that's very early. This costs $10,000. We went to one recently, and it was, like, more serious than I used to go into. I can't pronounce the artist's name, but he does these really intense dioramas, and as silly as that sounds, these are huge gothic things. Sometimes it's, like, 5 feet across, with detail down to the millimeter, with, like, tiny little sculptures that have been cut up and put back together again. And at that moment, I felt like I needed an explanation. You know, it was like, there's no serious, I need an explanation. And one wasn't provided, but that I got more at the fact that I was asking questions than being handed a fucking answer. Because I've been to places in London, I've been to places in New York where they do have that blurb, and that is just, you are just trying to talk the talk. That's what you're trying to do. If you were here right now and you used these words in front of me, or a portion of them, your charm, we'd be able to get across some of your point. Putting it on paper, you've lost me. In fact, you've ruined this for me. You're trying to provide answers, and it doesn't work for me. So I feel I'm wildly off point now about Latrobe.
But, well, I mean, pretty heavily off point, yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're all pretty pro Latrobe. One elephant in the room that I thought maybe worth discussing is, like, in terms of MISC prison films, Shawshank. Like, I mean, this is the film that's lauded as being... is it currently the best film of all time on IMDb?
Lauded.
Lauded? What did I say?
Lauded.
Lauded. Is it currently the number one film?
I think
film?
It's like two or three or something.
Or has it been...
It's probably still The Godfather. Let me find out. You know what? I think you're right. I think it's number one. I'll find out for you right now. Okay. Well, here's my Shawshank Redemption story. I've seen it dozens of times. I only saw the final 10 seconds... for the first time about a year ago. Yeah, it's number one. Because my VHS copy of it cut off just before the very last 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always imagined, like, Morgan Freeman, like, hugging him. Like, oh, we're back together. And I didn't know how it ended. But it didn't really matter to me. But yeah,
do you guys like the film?
I do, yeah. I think it gets a bit of an unfair rep for its populism. I mean, anything I've read against it tends to kind of slate it for being a bit sentimental and so on. But it's got a fairly hard edge to it if you strip away the kind of happy ending and escape. It has the sort of the classic nightmare stuff for prisons, because you have people there just being murdered in plain sight, and there are no consequences. Mm. You are not longer a part of you're no longer a part of society. You have no rights. You have no safeties other than the ones that suit the prison guards and the regime. I don't mind voiceovers in general. I think that the voiceover in this one it adds rather than just repeats. It expands. It gives some historical depth. It gives some emotional value to things that might be implied visually but are boosted. I would quite happily watch that film, every couple of years or so, and it's a really solid effort.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, a lot of people seem to be over it now and not really interested in having it considered, anywhere near the top of the pile. But I loved it when I was a little kid. I love it now. I think if there is any kind of magic. Like, if you choose to see any magic whatsoever in the kind of Hallmark, sentimental stories, if you choose to see that there's any value in those whatsoever, this film expands on or captures that magic so well, and it's such a warm and a film that, yeah, I mean, it's a really warm and inviting film that I find it so easy to watch. Mm-hmm. If it's on, I'll watch it. All the way through.
I mean, I think for me, whenever I get a film that gives a really believable and deep representation of friendship between characters.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much sold on it. If I believe that the people in this film would spend time together and know each other and love each other and know things about each other that the other don't even know about themselves, kind of thing, then I'm there. And whether it's, you know, this movie or like a Howard Hawks movie, if it's something that has a real coherent like group friendship or, you know, person to person friendship, then that tends to sway me in favour of it.
Yeah.
Because it just brings that sense of humanity, of showing you emotions and contexts that can happen and could happen and may happen. And
yeah,
that's the point of experiencing films and experiencing stories and different forms of art, is to give you windows into other lives that you might not have.
Yeah, I mean, that's right on. I think with this film specifically, for me, I latch on to that one expression of that one type of warmth that gets presented in that film in the same way. I haven't actually seen Stand By Me, but I can imagine it similarly captures something that kind of just resonates with people, and it's this one mood that maybe something to do with adolescence, something to do with friendships that you had when you were a kid, and nostalgia and risk and stuff like that, but it captures one tone perfectly, and that's what draws people back. And in this film it does something very, very similar, where it's a kind of sentimentality and a kind of bonding and a kind of existential thing that's going on in it. And it's whatever it is, whatever the whole cocktail gets made up to, is something that's kind of irresistible to me, and I really look forward to it whenever I sit down and see it. And I mean, it's a cliche to say by now, but like Morgan Freeman's voice was kind of made for the voiceover in that film, which is just so perfectly pitched and just so cathartic. You just feel something as he's speaking. It's an incredibly involving film that I think doesn't get enough credit for being that way. Do you like the film, Jack, or are you kind of over it now?
No, I'm not over it at all. I feel like I'm in danger of overwatching it. Like I say, I've seen it dozens of times. I had it on VHS. I ruined my copy. I didn't see it for something very long stretch after that. Let me think. Something close to like 6-7 years. We were talking about all-time classics. Can we mention The Shawshank Redemption got added to Netflix that week? It's like you said. It's like, why wouldn't I watch that right now? Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't I? I mean, it's not my favorite film, but it's close enough to my top of my pile and everyone else's that it deserves the credit it gets. And it's easy to watch with disturbing themes. You know, and it's just a skill. You can't put that down, the fact that this is accessible to you, something as horrible as a false conviction for 20 years being explained to my age, a child, and having that be accessible, you know, to that level of emotion without it being something to disturb you intentionally, is a huge achievement. And I like the fact, just thematically, that you don't know it's an escape film until the last 20 minutes. It's just about people dealing with their life. Mm. And the fact that it gives you that as an escape, it no way diminishes the film. It's not cheesy. People wanted to do that. People have escaped from chain gangs and prisons, especially in that era. So I don't think it's unworthy, because it gives you a reward. Okay? Just the people are allowed to go on with their life after prison, whether it be, you know, Red coming out and getting on with his life, or Andy Dufresne, who says that I am not supposed to be here and never was, and I will not be here. You know, get busy living or get busy dying. And it's a very powerful, very worthy film that I will see again probably in a year. I will. It's just there. And I understand why it's top of the IMDb top 100. That film bombed when it came out.
Yeah.
It didn't do well. It got its following on VHS and on TV showings, and its reputation is just grew to the status it's got just now. Frank Darabont was talking about it and how it's like he doesn't ever expect to do anything remotely close to the level of reaction it's got since. And he knows he's living on, you know, whatever that movie's given him, not financially, but just his career. And that he's just, you know, how grateful he is towards it and he doesn't feel like his creator anymore. It's just something bigger than him, and he's just humbled by it. And yeah, it's just a fantastic film. I do this often. You hit a core key, and I will just gush. It's really easy to be gushy about things you enjoy. I make a concise effort.
I think it's an admirable film, and if you can get something with, I mean, it's a good couple hours long, and there's not really a misstep in it in terms of its pacing. It doesn't lag. Everything that's there feels that it's earned its place. Even like, I think the scene where the old guy Banks is released, the librarian guy. I mean, that operates. That you could simply show that without any of the film proceeding and anything subsequent as a short film about a guy getting out of prison, and it says it all about the institutionalization of people and the kind of the terror that prison has of taking you out of the world and then, you know, you're dropped back into it generations later, and just how disturbing and dangerous that is for people. But yeah, I think it's quite something to have that powerful a short movie that could stand on its own in the midst of that wider narrative, and it doesn't jar, it doesn't interrupt, it just integrates seamlessly into it. I think it's really good.
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, it's one of those films, I think it's easy to forget how formative it was for me. Like, I always remember Psycho, I remember Trainspotting, I remember Pulp Fiction. I never remember Shawshank Redemption, but it was a film that was, like, put in my hands by my parents when they first realised that I was really getting into films. And like you say, Jack, it was the VHS copy getting worn out just from, you know, repeated watching and putting it in other people's hands and saying, look, you need to see this. And I do think it just has a certain type of magic that's very rare. It's a magic that you can be cynical about, but I don't think it pays to be cynical about it because it has so much reward built into it.
Yeah, it's the kind of cynicism that you get when you're, you know, when you're maybe a teenager who, you know, it's like with children and parents, and children love their parents for the childhood and then to hate them as a teenager, and then when you come back around into, you know, 20s and mid-20s, you're like, no, actually, you're pretty decent people. I like you. I like spending time with you.
Well, I'd end on that. That's a good high point for this one, but I mean, that was not something we planned to watch, but honestly,
I watched it maybe just a couple of weeks ago just because, you know, the films that we'd been talking about had been on my mind, and I watched a couple of other things just as points of, you know, of note. There wasn't anything that I want to really explore too much in this. There was nothing that stood out as being, this is great, you have to watch it. There's just a couple of films that were alright and just kind of let me think about these ones through that filter of another movie, you know. But no, it's good. I've enjoyed the conversation. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, likewise.
Well, until next time,
it's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Film Interrupted. If you want to contact us, we can be reached at Film Interrupted on Gmail, Tumblr, Facebook, and of course iTunes. If you'd like to contact us on Letterboxd, I can be found under TechnoSnob303, Martin under Martino Heat, and Nick under Nick Edie. Nice handle, Nick.